Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the guy running the Limark Technical Net tonight. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we gather together in front of our radios, and we inform each other. We learn from each other. We teach each other. Hopefully, we entertain each other a bit. And I thank you all for joining me this Sunday night at 8 o'clock when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop it. I'll give you the usual links. If you want to contact me via email, we have an email address for you. That's for what we used to call mailbag questions, a thing of the past, where people who wouldn't be able to reach us on the radio Sunday night at 8 could email us with questions, and if appropriate, we try and answer. You can either listen to an internet audio stream of the Technical Net or download a file of the archive sites, your option. Also, the email address is for topics of discussion. If anyone has expertise in a subject, a technical subject that's come up on the news, and they want to share it with the rest of us, you can contact me and we can arrange for something. Or if you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always looking for them. They're as rare as hen's teeth. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to talk about something you saw recently, NASA or space-related, you can, of course, contact him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. I offer a link page of interesting articles, YouTubes, what have you, that I've seen throughout the week. I cut and paste them and put them on a page, and they're available 24/7. So all you need to do to get to them is to type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room available. It tends to be quiet these days, but you never know. So if you want to check it out, type into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and that will bring you to our chat room. And as I mentioned earlier, we have an audio stream on the Internet of the Technical Net, and I leave it live for the rest of the week, so you can listen to the Glen Oaks repeater without a radio if you want. To get to there, you just type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com. And I always like to remind people that MikeKC2NJI has an archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So when you have a chance, check it out. It's full of the wisdom of amateur radio operators who have either moved away from the area or unfortunately become silent keys. Their wisdom persists on audio files, and take advantage of that. Let me drop for a second, and I'll be back with what we got planned for tonight. Okay, it's a kind of a normal night. I will ask people if they have any questions or comments or topics for discussion. I would prefer if the first few entries are amateur radio related, but as we all know, I will entertain any science or technologically based subject matter that people present as best I can. That should take us, hopefully, to 10:15 when Paul will join us for the SpaceNet report. That should take us to 11 p.m. where I will return to tie a bow on things and wish you well for this week. So that's the plan if laws of physics continue to work and my shack works and the repeater works. All have been known to fail us at times, but all things being equal, most of the time we get through it to 11 plus without any problems. So with that in mind, let me just lately I've been kind of starting the Technical Net with a very short discussion of what I've noticed on my 10-meter nets. I run a 10-meter net most of the time Sunday mornings at 11 p.m. on 28.380. And once again, an awful propagation day. My DX station of the morning and early afternoon was a guy in New Jersey who I'm thankful that he participated, but there were no long-distance contacts whatsoever on 10-meter to be had. It was as quiet, unfortunately, as it's been for far too long. So that's my little 10-meter report that I've gotten to adding in. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limelight Technical Net. If anyone has any technical questions or comments or topics for discussion, please hit that push to talk. Give me your call sign and your first name.
Hello, this is Brian, Kilo Foxtrot 2ZULU, over.
Hello, Brian. Do you have a question or a topic tonight, or are you just saying hello?
Well, this is my first time here, so I would like to go ahead and say hello. I'm in Rockland County, New York, and I'd like to know if the information that you mentioned with all the emails and other addresses and information will be posted or are posted on the Limelight website. Thank you.
Oh, okay. I don't know. Usually not, unfortunately. I don't have a direct connection with the guy who writes the website. But I could set it up on my link page. You just have to know to type in roy.ac2gs.com, and that's the link page with all the links available. And if you want, I could post the email addresses there as well.
Hey, Roy, I know mine's not on the site, but, you know, it could happen now. This is WS2N.
Roy, could you come back with your call again, please, with that address?
Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. That's Roy, R-O-Y, Romeo Oscar Yankee, dot Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, dot C-O-M.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I'm not even sure about who writes, who manage site, so I don't even know who to ask or tell or what have you. I just maintain my own sites. And so if you go to the places that I send you to, they're up to date. I change it every week. Every week you'll see a new group of Roy's links, and we try to keep it fresh. Anyway, once again, if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion tonight, we're open for business. Please hit that push to talk and ID yourself.
Curious question.
Yes, or would that be?
How come there's static on FM?
How come there is static on FM? It sort of depends upon whether the signal is strong enough to entertain full capture. If the amplitude is not high enough, you don't have full capture, and so you will have a background noise that sounds very much like static in the background. It's not static in the same way that amplitude modulation is, where, you know, if you're anywhere near a lightning storm or such, you're going to hear the crashes of harmonics of the electromagnetic storm from the lightning, but you will get noise. FM is a relatively low noise modulation mode, but it's not free 100% of any random noise.
Is it kind of like a frequency scatter kind of artifact?
I wouldn't consider it a frequency scatter. It simply hasn't locked in the FM detectors fully. And so you just have a background electrical noise in the detection circuits being able to be heard. If you pump in enough frequency modulated signal through the detector, you should have a point where most of that random electrical noise is shut down, and the fidelity of a full capture FM signal gives you the best kind of noise percentage that you can get in most of the, you know, as opposed to amplitude modulation or a single sideband, which is just a variation on that amplitude modulation.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, please.
Roy, KC2SHO here. I think you alluded to it, but you didn't say it directly. Isn't most of that noise generated internally in the circuitry of the receiver?
Yeah. The problem is in the electrical detector stage, where you have electrical noise If you're able to get enough of a signal to go full capture, you can eliminate most of it. But yeah, it's as opposed to, we mentioned earlier, amplitude modulation, very often a lot of the noise is external. Lightning storms and electromagnetic noise generated from all kinds of devices in the area. So yeah, the primary noise that's dampened with FM detectors are internal to the electronics, and you know, you simply can't have a noise-free environment ultimately, because any thermal energy, anything above absolute zero, is going to produce some degree of electrical noise.
Yeah, real good. That's the way I understood it. And help me out a little more. Is there a theoretical lower limit? I know they're always trying to make quieter receivers, and I'm sure the most high-end type receivers might have some kind of cryogenics or something like that. Maybe you could tell us more about what's the way to get to the most sensitive receiver, and is there a theoretical lower limit?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it goes way past any amateur radio operator's budget. But in aerospace, you know, when NASA and JPL are doing their thing, you know, they factor in that as long as they stay in the shade in space, the temperature is very low, and sometimes, despite that low temperature, they still have cryogenic devices. The absolute lowest limit of internal noise is dependent upon your temperature, and if you can get your temperature to absolute zero, then it's non-existent, unfortunately, because of most of the laws of physics, you can't get absolute zero. You can get incredibly close. Mathematicians love to use the term asymptotic. You approach zero, but you never reach zero. So, there's a never-ending lower limit depending upon your technology to bring the temperature of the receiver closer and closer to absolute zero, which is ultimately unobtainable. It's like accelerating some object with mass to the speed of light. You can get close to it, but you can't reach it.
Yeah, very interesting. And I guess my final thought there is... I think, I don't know if it was here or maybe it was on one of the other nets we were talking not long ago about the signals received back from Voyager, and I think, if I remember right, at the time looking at the signal coming back, it was minus 170 dBm, which is just absolutely insane. I wonder if that's some kind of record or if there's been something even lower. Of course, the distance and the actual signal level might be the record, but boy, that sounds like you're starting to get on the edge of what any current technology can do. I wonder how much lower it could go.
Well, you know, I mean, maybe we'll have a word or two from Paul. He's our NASA and space expert, but it's sort of a matter of how much gain you can figure out on the Earth. Theoretically, if you cover the entire planet that's facing these satellites, devices, you can crank out a signal with even higher gain. It's just a matter of antenna coverage, you know, how much surface area, how much gain you're capable of manifesting. And there's an electronic limitation to the ability for solid-state equipment to increase the gain of a signal past the antenna reception. In that case, it again becomes a case of you have to cool it down to the lowest temperature you can to improve the low noise, high sensitive nature of high gain amplifiers. So probably it's not a limit. If we build some more ground stations and tweak some more low noise, high gain amplifiers, we may be able to hear from that device for a bit longer, but eventually we run out of real estate, we run out of money to put things up. So inevitably, we are going to reach a point where the rubber band is going to break.
Yeah, very interesting, and look forward to maybe hearing what Paul has to say, or maybe reading something online about the lower limitations and what we can expect in the future. Real good. Thank you, Roy. Good subject. The other station brought up. We've got the gears turning here. Back to you, Roy. EC2GS from KC2.
Okay, very good, John. As always, I thank you for your participation. As far as laboratory experiments, I am sure they have played around with ultra low signal strength in the lab, but labs usually don't lend themselves to enormous high gain ground receivers. So probably the closest experiments that are done with ultra low level space emissions are done in the way that we were just talking about, and not particularly in the lab. You can reproduce the low energy emissions. You can reproduce the high gain, low noise amplification circuits, but you can't really pack ground stations into a lab, as far as I can perceive. Paul, if you got anything on this and you want to share, please feel free.
I missed the first part. The low end of what? Frequency or temperature? What are we talking about?
No, we were talking about being able to still receive our distant transmitters after all this time and through all space, and the attenuation of the signal has gotten weaker and weaker and weaker, and yet we've been able to continue to receive. So the question is, has NASA or JPL done anything specific as far as research into the field to kind of get a better understanding of how long we can keep this up?
Oh, I get it. Yeah, there's at least, there's around 40 space probes that the Deep Space Network is really involved with, and 16 are at, you know, really good distances. The two most popular ones, of course, is Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. But also, you know, you have New Horizon that's on its way past Pluto now, and that's into the Kuiper Belt. Even taking pictures of a Kuiper Belt object, Thuler, I think it was, and you know, they hope to keep going with that thing. That the camera works and everything. Voyager doesn't. Voyager is down to four instruments, so the signals that come back are still readable. But if NASA did nothing over these decades to their equipment, they did not upgrade all their equipment in not only Goldstone in California, where it's one of the deep space networks are, but they did them also in Madrid, Spain. That's where a couple of the other big ones are, as well as Canberra down in Australia. They've increased, like, in Australia, they increased the size of the dish down there. Yeah. In fact, they've increased the size of the dish in a number of places. It's not like there's three antennas. I know they're all set at 120 degrees apart, but there's like, you know, three or four at least antennas in each location, and different diameters. And they've improved on the receiving capability of the low-noise amplifiers over the decades. So, you know, I remember reading not too long ago, if they did nothing, we wouldn't be able to get that whisper of a signal from any of the Voyagers. So there you go. Especially Voyager 1, by the way. That's on a different plane, a ecliptic plane. So most of the times they can only use their one of the antennas from the Deep Space Network, you know, depending how the Earth is facing. But, you know, they're still at it. They just got everything back online recently. All four experiments for Voyager 1 is now working. And they're receiving science data finally after 6 months, about 3 or 4 months of experimentation. And now, you know, just I think a week or two ago, they're now receiving actual data. Hope I didn't time it out. Back to you, Roy. WS2N.
SF2CZ.
Yeah, Brian?
I'm curious, on those probes, such as Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, what type of modulation scheme are they using to the, deep space network?
Well, you know this better than I.
Well, the signals that are coming back, I know they're on 8 gigahertz. What they're using for, it's naturally, of course, it's all digital, but what's the pulse something? I forget the one that they use. But it's from 1970s, from the 1970s. Trying to think of, I could probably find that on probably Wikipedia. I'm not really sure. Right, naturally there's zeros and ones coming back, and the bit rate is down to, I think, 160, way down low. And of course the one-way transmission for Voyager 1 is 20, like, I think it's 22 hours now in one direction. But I'm not sure the modulation scheme. It's not like PSK-31, they didn't have any of that. Whatever they had in the 70s, back to you, Roy.
Okay, I would assume it's some phase shift keying to get the bits out. It's probably, it was launched a little too early for interesting modifications like quadrature shift keying and other higher shift keying modalities that are used on our cell phones these days. But I would assume it's a phase shift keying in some digital mode.
Well, it seems that they're only transmitting with the power, I think, of a 10 or 20 watt light bulb.
Yeah, well, when you're stuck, you use what you got. It's still amazing to me that although, like most things, attenuation of electromagnetic waves is not a binary one and zero. So ultimately, you get to the point where I guess you're down to one single photon and something goes wrong with it. As long as you don't pass by anything that absorbs RF, what happens is the photons don't cease to exist. They simply spread out in surface area wider and wider, disperse, and the total energy level gets less and less. You need greater gain to collect it. So, yeah, it's kind of amazing what 10 watts will do if you have a really good budget for the receiving system.
Hey, Roy, they're 25. They started off with 25, and there's two traveling wave tubes on each Voyager, to give you an idea. Now, that number has decreased over the years, the output, but I think it was 25 watts that they started with.
Oh, okay. I mean, back when it was designed, I'm sure the engineers gave it a little bit extra wiggle room, but I'm sure a lot of those engineers didn't foresee that we would still be building up our ground stations and still able to hear them as far as they are today.
Yeah, that was pretty good for 8 gig back then, too, That's what it is. They have another band, but that was when they were very close to Earth. Once they got out, past Mars or something, they couldn't use that anymore. But they've been transmitting on 8 gig. And don't forget, there's a 12-foot dish, too. I think it's 11 and a half feet, something like that, dish that they're using as well to transmit back.
Okay, very good. I mean, it's a wonder of engineering. Those guys were very, very clever, and there were a lot of them, and there were a lot of safeguards, and there were a lot of things that don't seem to be in place these days. These days, you just kind of set things off and see if they blow up or see if they work. So I have a lot more confidence in the engineering of the 1960s, even with their technological limitations. I think their policies of how they did things was a lot more efficient than the policy that NASA seems to have crayoned together these days.
I can't understand the point.
Yeah, that they needed, you know, 10 watts, they doubled it, you know. that was the mindset, you know. You know, we need maybe a 8-foot dish. Well, let's make it a 12-foot dish. You know, bigger, stronger, but, you know, better to be safe than sorry. I think that was the engineering way back then. Nowadays, let's figure it out, the exact, to the finest decimal point we can, and maybe we'll make it a decimal point bigger, and cross your fingers and hope it works 20 years from now.
Yeah, they call that over-engineering. American engineers tended to do that. German engineers tended to do that. Russian engineers didn't. Chinese engineers don't. So, you know, I mean, I just wish some of the old-timers had been kind of frozen in something and thought out to help this new generation. Because I don't have the faintest idea when that moon mission is going to take off. It really does need Starship, and Starship hasn't proved 95% of the things it needs to prove to go into service. So I wouldn't put any money down for Artemis to kind of do what it's scheduled to do on any kind of schedule I'm aware of.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they got the contract for the first landing, but hey, if they don't make it, you know, Blue Origin is right behind them. They're building Blue Moon, I believe is their name, and it's a big honking lander, you know, where you can land four people if you want it, you know, and they're working on that. So, I mean, there is a plan B, but right now Starship is, you know, they're still up front, but if they can't make it for any reason, they're going to have Blue Origin. And at some point, if things keep going, they'll actually have both. You know, you'll have two of these things by different companies attached to the Gateway space station going up and down. So, I mean, that would be great, but I think we got a long wait. It's going to be delayed. Starship has got a long way to go before you put people on that thing, all the way to the moon.
Yeah, does Bezos' company, Plan B, require multi-refueling on you know, during the missions?
No, it's different, but it does require, you know, like a perfect seal type of thing. Because he's going to use liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen with his lander. So that you know, you can't have any leaks. There's not going to be any way to make up the fuel that he brings with him. Where SpaceX is going to need multiple refuelings. We'll see. But they both have contracts. I mean, you know, these are contracts signed with NASA. These are multi-billion-dollar contracts. And you know, I don't know how far along they are. You know, it's hard to get updates on this type of thing. But, you know, they have reports to NASA is, you know, everything's going along fine. But right now, SpaceX should be ready with Starship in a couple of years. You know, next September is a launch without Starship. That's going to be, you know, out to the moon and back with crew of four. So the following one would be the one with lander from Starship. And then the one after that would be a lander with Blue Origin. That's the plan. You know, that's all going to change. You know, if it doesn't change, I'll be surprised. Back to you,
Brian. AC2GS. As I will. Brian, you wanted to say something?
Well, it looks to me really that it's just a updated design, but it's the same old stuff. Chemical rockets. No centrifugal force, no gravity, artificial gravity. It was once a movie called Mission to Mars. I mean, it was a budget sci-fi flick, but it had some good technical aspects to it.
Well, yeah, but all things considered, you know, every time you introduce something new and flashy, you have to prove that it works, and it works consistently, otherwise people die. The whole NASA program back in Apollo was not to be flashy. Just get the job done. Propulsion is propulsion. The basic chemistry of propulsive fuels has not really changed in, 70, 80 years. They're oxidizers and reducing agents. You put them together, you set them on fire, and you had propulsion. We don't have anti-gravity waves. We don't have anti-gravity or gravitational fields. If we introduced rotation into a ship, we would have to make the ship massive. Otherwise, the centrifugal forces would probably either sicken everyone or kill everyone. So although things work out nicely on a CGI budget in Hollywood, to make it a reality is a different thing entirely, unfortunately. So I'm not that worried that they're reusing old technology, because the old technology got us to the moon the first time. So probably something similar would be able to get us to the moon the second time. Introducing semi-weird things like needing to refuel a rocket 12 times in the vacuum of space accurately and correctly and get most of the fuel where it's supposed to go, that's a massive big question mark. No one's even tried to do that. They've done what they said was tests of that type, in which they just exchanged fuel from one engine inside Starship to another engine inside Starship, which is a lot easier than two separate Starships in outer space docking and refueling one from the other. So I would be more optimistic if they kept it simple at least the first few times. If they want to get flashy later on, then Godspeed.
The solution to the problem basically is that there has to be a sea change in the propulsion system. And the only thing that I could think of that would do that, and of course it's early on yet, but, you know, getting a little bit closer incrementally every day, and that's fusion power.
Fusion power. Fusion power will be here in 20 years. 50 years ago, fusion power would be here 50 years. You know, 70 years ago, I think fusion was supposed to be here in 20 years. Don't depend on fusion. I agree with you in concept that a lot of future space projects really require a revolutionary change in the means of our rocket propulsion. And some ion drive, maybe. But that's, as you said, far in the future. Right now we're stuck with oxidizers and reducing agents, and probably at least for the next 50 years will be. So we got to play with the toys that the universe has given us for now.
One thing about the ion drives, Roy, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
When Starship and Blue Moon are attached to a space station out there that will be orbiting the moon. To get that space station in, it's going to be, you know, multiple modules. But the first two, the propulsion unit and the habitat module, are going to be launched together. You know, they're going to be bolted together here on Earth and launched in one shot on a Falcon Heavy rocket, not a Starship rocket. You know, it's collectively, each one is like, you know, 20,000 pounds. So, you know, it's a massive thing. They'll get it into Earth orbit. But just to get it to the moon, they really don't have enough fuel on a Falcon Heavy to do that, you know, in a couple of few days. So they are going to use haul ion thrusters. Four of them are going to be attached to the first two modules of the Gateway space station, and that will be pushing it out ever so slowly to the moon. I think they're looking at 6 months or something, just to get from, you know, from Earth orbit all the way to the moon, which would, you know, for humans, you know, if it's a chemical flight, it's three, you know, 3.5-4 days. But you know, they're not going to be in any rush. That won't be manned. It'll get into lunar orbit, and then to stabilize and keep them in lunar orbit, they're going to continue to use those fall thrusters. They're a lot more powerful than the ones that they're using now. You know, I mean, they're still relatively weak compared to chemical rockets, but they will be using them. The ISP, ratio, the higher the number, the better it is. Chemical rockets are, you know, somewhere around, good ones are like 400, and this thing's like 800 or so, or 900 for their rating, you know. So, you know, that's coming up. The Hall thrusters, their ion thrusters, four of them. I mean, they use them all the time anyway, but this will actually be on a, especially on a manned craft as it goes around the moon. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, that's good. That's great. You know, you're not going to get this acceleration you need for any kind of manned space flight, but, you know, it's another method to play with. Yeah, I've said this kind of a whole bunch of times, and unfortunately, it's kind of a pointless thing to discuss too much. It's sort of like a bunch of guys on a radio net back in 1920 discussing personal computers. You know, I lack the imagination to be able to make up what technological advances the next century will have, you know, if anyone kind of is able to game something that's sort of like gravitational forces, which I don't think so. You need to be able to manipulate space-time. So who knows what the future will bring, but I think it's going to require significant revolution in propulsion systems before any of these things is more than just kind of, to a degree, daydreams, you know? I mean, I still have my problems with manned flights on Mars. And to Mars, it takes a lot of time. It's going to knock the heck out of the astronauts, and there's no support system on the other end. So I don't know how they'd survive the physical requirements of landing and being able to kind of move around in even a low gravity environment, and you know, other than eating supplies, making fresh supplies. So I think robotics is the answer in the short haul. Unfortunately, it doesn't make everyone tingle to think of robots on Mars. They want human beings, but I think that's the practical approach. By the way, as I've mentioned before, John KD2BD listens to our stream, I think in New Jersey, and he responds in the chat room. And someone else was sitting in the chat room discussing what we were talking about, and this other guy feels that Voyager used phase shift keying modulation, which is probable. Maybe not PSEK-32, but something very close to that in a phase shift keying type of mode. And John discussed with him the thought that maybe an 8-pole shift keying was the mode that they used, but I don't know if that was the case. Anyway, that's what John and Mark in the chat room had to say.
Brian, KF2CZ. I think, really, if they're able to produce liquid, or I don't know if it'll be in a liquid state, they'll have to make it in a liquid state, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen on the moon, I think that would be wonderful, because then you're really dealing with only 1/6 of Earth's gravity.
Well, that's true, and that's why there have been people who have written in science fiction novels catapults. The idea is that you can't build a catapult big enough on the Earth to negate to reach the escape velocity to get it into orbit or into space, whereas you might be able to build something on the moon. So, you know, it's less of an effort to get things off of the moon because it has a smaller gravitational well. But you also have to realize we don't know how much water is really out there. We don't know what it will take. It takes energy to melt ice into water. It takes energy to electrolytically separate oxygen and hydrogen. You need storage facilities. You need cryogenic or pressurizing devices. And it requires a great deal of hydrogen and oxygen. And you're going to need the oxygen for the people on the moon to breathe, too. So, you know, how long would it take to fill up one single rocket? It very possibly, depending upon how many, how much equipment you've been able to haul over there, could take a century. So, you know, there's a lot of little problems along the way.
Interesting thought that came up to my mind. Since they want to decommission the ISS around 2030, why can't they just move the ISS, refurbish it, and supplement it, and move the ISS in orbit around the moon?
Well, Paul, do you want to discuss the amount of energy it's required to do something like that?
Okay, I was going to talk about the catapult, which you got nothing to do. Look, put in spin launch company, rocket company. It's not a rocket, but they've got this massive contraption on Earth. Right now it's in New Mexico, and they want to put it somewhere else. At like 100 feet in diameter, this thing spins at 10,000 RPM in a vacuum, and then in the last split second, it releases the payload. It goes through membranes, you know, the whole thing's a vacuum inside, and the thing takes off. It goes like 4,000 miles per hour, and then, well, they've been experimenting. They've done hundreds of tests with this thing already, but eventually they would put like a little second stage on top of it, and you'd be able to get small satellites to orbit. But I remember talking to Dick about this thing years ago, and I thought it was going to go away. And they're still experimental ones. It's just a couple of weeks ago I read more about the spin launch company. And the ISS going to the moon, now you're not going to move that 1 million pounds over 1 million pounds to, not much higher than the 250 miles where it is now above the Earth. You can't accelerate it from 17,500 miles an hour to another 25,000 miles per hour. You'd have to increase it, you'd have to increase the speed by 7,000 miles per hour, and that's, can't do that. The amount of rockets that you'd have attached to this thing to even get it to a higher orbit, escape a velocity of 25,000 miles an hour, it's just not feasible. But yeah, they're going to eventually deorbit that. In fact, SpaceX just got the contract for like $1 billion to do that. They'll be talking about that in the years to come. I think, by the way, I think it's going to go a little past 2030. My guess is 2032, something like that, would be the time frame. Back to you, Russ.
Yeah, I would agree.
Things to keep viable, having that up there. But wouldn't it be interesting if they could find some way of maybe accelerating it out of orbit, but toward the moon, and be able to go ahead and put it in a orbit? It's just fun thinking.
Yeah, it might be fun thinking, but if you think in terms of how much energy it takes to move things in space, a lot. I'm not even sure if the ISS is in the same orbital plane as you would want for it to be kind of an equatorial satellite for the moon. Do you know, Paul, if it's in the same plane?
No, you're right. Was it 51.6 degrees inclination, where the moon is, a couple of degrees off. I think roughly 6 degrees or so off the equator. So you're way off. You know, you're off by 45 degrees. You know, but yeah, you know, see, just to get the Orion spacecraft, the one that they tested 2 Decembers ago, that went around the moon and came back. Now, that thing is roughly, you know, like with the service module, probably 30, maybe close to 40,000 pounds. You got the heaviest rocket, the SLS, that we launched from Earth to get that, to go to the moon. Now, that's without even having enough fuel on board to slow it down to land on the moon. Yeah, that was a free return, they call it. It just orbited the moon, and, you know. And they didn't have to buy the rockets to actually orbit the moon and stay in orbit. So they're barely able to get, you know, 30,000 pounds to the moon. Now, to try to get 1,000,000 pounds to the moon, you know, how many starships would you need or SLS to do that? You know, at 10 million pounds. I think the SLS was close to 10 million pounds of thrust. Not going to happen anytime soon. It just, you know, can you imagine pushing anything 7,000 miles an hour faster, you know, whether it's in orbit or on Earth? You know, the amount of thrust to do that and the fuel that it takes to do that, it's quite a bit. And you know, I'm not kidding, that thing weighs 1 million pounds. And in the future, they plan on attaching a couple of modules to the front, Axiom, within a couple of years. A couple of modules will be attached to the front of the space station. And then when they do decide to get rid of the space station, those modules will be disconnected, and that'll be Axiom's own space station. Those modules will disconnect. It'll have its own solar panels and everything. So, there's a lot to discuss. I hope we're still here in a couple of years from now to do this, Roy. God willing, back to you.
I certainly hope so, Paul. I mean, getting back to the bride, it's a fun make-believe, you know. It could be the basis of a science fiction a novel or novella. But ultimately, you'd need to borrow Star Trek's inertial dampeners to do anything like that. It would sort of be like using a speedboat to nudge a battleship. You know, I mean, and probably that's an optimistic comparison.
Just amazes me that when I look at the Saturn V versus the SLS, it's just basically, you know, a little bit newer technology, but basically same old.
Well, yeah, but we're not doing anything relatively new. I mean, the only real parameter I'm aware of that's different is the number of people and the amount of time and effort they're going to have once they land on the moon. So, I mean, ultimately, it's a very similar mission. Again, it doesn't need any razzmatazz. It doesn't, you know, I mean, the equipment that will be used will be state-of-the-art 2024 or such. You know, we won't have any floppies in our computers. You know, we'll be using the latest, greatest, electronic technology. But as far, again, as space propulsion is involved, there have not been any great revolutionary breakthroughs since the 60s and before. It's a matter of just kind of modifying engine design, tweaking things. Nothing really new has showed up. Chemistry, you know, chemistry does not evolve as quickly as, say, solid-state electronics. So, and propulsion is ultimately chemistry, at least at this point.
Well, certainly it has a lot to do with energy. You know, the amount of energy that you would need to go ahead and use to move things is pretty much a constant. You can't change the laws of physics, really.
Unless you're writing for Star Trek, then they got warp drives, they got inertial dampeners, they got fake gravity Generators, they got all kinds of fun stuff that defy most of our understanding of modern-day physics. And, you know, maybe there's a way to get around it. You never know what the real core of physics truly is. We just peel away the layers until we get closer and closer and closer to what it really is. But we still don't fundamentally know the universe. Who knows if we ever will? You know, people yell and argue about gravity. Physicists do experiments to test gravitational fields in the high extremes and the low extremes to this day, trying to disprove Einstein's theory of relativity. And so far, it's stuck. It hasn't been disproven. But they'll keep on experimenting at the higher gravitational fields and the lowest gravitational fields just to see if there's any kind of wiggle room at the extremes.
There are so many galaxies out there in the universe and so many planets that I think that if there wasn't any life out there, which I believe that there's significant life out there, it would be an awful waste of space.
Well, I mean, that's from your and my perspective. Space, you probably does not have much of an opinion one way or the other. It just is. It follows its rules. Things happen not because, at least in my mind, not because some ultimate purpose, but because that's the way things are made to happen. So I think there is intelligent life in the universe other than our own. I sometimes question whether we qualify. But the problem, as I see it, is that space is so humongous, so huge, that the chances of two intelligent life forms going to the trouble of traveling so far to meet up is negligible. So I think there's intelligent life out there. I don't think we've been visited by it, because I think it would require the wealth of maybe a galaxy to manifest the engineering equipment to get from here to there and back again. But again, maybe they have a warp drive, you know, that they use as they watch Star Trek episodes.
Could it be that it's possible, you know, there might be wormholes, but that hasn't entirely been proven.
Yeah, wormholes are very interesting. Wormholes are completely theoretical. No wormhole has ever been observed as far as humanity is concerned. But the theoretical problems with wormholes is severe. Wormholes require something called negative energy to not collapse in on themselves, and no one quite knows what negative energy is. So that's a big problem. And the theoretical wormholes that people have calculated have a diameter at one point of less than a proton. So nothing's going through there. You know, it's kind of difficult if you have a hole that's smaller than any substance in the universe. It's kind of difficult for anything to go through it. So at this point, even the theoretical wormholes are deeply problematic, even if they actually do exist.
True. However, you know, keep in mind that it only takes the spark of invention to go ahead and change the world, too. So I leave it at that.
AC2GS. Well, yeah. Like I said, I don't know what the future holds. I don't know what get-out-of-jail card some brilliant engineer physicist will come up with. But chances are nothing's going to violate some of the more intrinsic laws of physics. So you might be able to develop a better mouse trap, but you probably won't be able to design a mouse trap to trap mice in Alpha Centauri anytime too soon.
Okay, FQCC Prime. Yeah, I would agree with that statement. It's a lot of complex things that we just do not know about. And, you know, these take time and research and perhaps a little bit of luck, or a lot of luck.
Yeah, I agree. You need curious people. You need the general social freedom for curious people to research what they are curious about. And you need a lot of luck, and you need the laws of physics to work for you. You know, there's nothing as bad as when a scientific concept starts to be adopted as a political stance, and then you have the inevitable people who support it despite anything, and others who do want to destroy it at all costs. The Soviet Union had a big problem with genetics for decades because they believed in a really awful theory of genetics that shouldn't have been promoted by them. It slowed down their own genetic research by decades. So you got to keep an open mind. But as I've often said, you don't want your mind so open that your brain falls out. So, you know, cold fusion and things that most likely don't really exist, you got to kind of be able to figure out what is worth researching and what isn't quite worth researching, which can be difficult at times.
Question about that. By the way, going ahead and switching gears for a moment, have there been any new developments in power supply technology in terms of making it smaller, more efficient, and more reliable?
Okay, that's a good question. Unfortunately, the simple answer is no. I think about a year or so ago, Wesley brought up that Tesla had invented a new battery that was going to revolutionize batteries. What effectively it was a larger battery. It had the same inherent materials, and it just packed them a little bit tighter and built them a little bit bigger. Unfortunately, I think it's actually Panasonic who was the battery manufacturer and designer, not really Tesla. They just kind of took the credit for it. Production of those batteries have been fraught with problems. They have not been able to produce them in the numbers they need in a cost-viable manner, and so they may give up totally on that new design. But it's still a lithium-ion battery. The problem is that, again, you have to deal with chemistry unless you want to deal with physics. Batteries are chemical reactors. They're in a sense very similar to propulsion systems. They have oxidizers, they have reducers. The only difference is that the electron transfers occur outside of the battery as opposed to a rocket fuel. When it burns, the electron transfers are internal to the engine. So everyone's kind of looking for something new, and they're thinking of different materials to make the electrodes out of, and they're thinking of solid-state batteries, which is the vaguest concept I've ever heard. I've never read an article that really explains what a solid-state battery is. They tend to pump it up with a lot of possible features. It will take a higher energy density. It'll take less time to charge. It will be capable of many more cycles of charge-discharge. And yet they can't really explain what it's made of or how. They just kind of voodoo it by saying that it has something to do with quantum entanglement as a storage method. I don't know how you store energy in quantum entanglement. I don't know how you maintain quantum entanglement. It tends to not last forever. So that's something they're talking about, graphene. I used to do regular reports on graphene. And one of the many things that they were prophesizing is that graphene would give us the capability of much higher charges and shorter recycle time and stuff like that. So it yet may happen. Graphene is very difficult to manufacture in more than laboratory quantities, so it's not cost-effective yet, but someone in a lab might have discovered something this weekend that we don't know about. So they're all working on it, but as of right now, there is nothing particularly dramatically that's going to change the factors. They can squeeze a couple of extra amp hours out of something by tweaking the chemistry a bit here or there, but nothing revolutionary, at least nothing that I've heard of.
Well, I agree with that. I think solid-state battery refers to an electrolyte that is not liquid or gelatinous.
No, I beg to differ. When these articles are talking about solid state, they're talking of it more in terms of semiconductors being solid state physics. They're not talking about it as liquid phase or solid phase batteries. That's a different subject.
You mean semiconductors actually storing?